So welcome back. This is the Momentum Advisors Podcast. This week is a special episode. Last week we did a financial show talking about surviving the current administration. We went through a lot of financial things. What's happening with interest rates? What you should be doing with your stock portfolio? This week's a little different because we have to literally survive the Trump administration. We've had DEI completely attacked. It's been made to seem like it stands for didn't earn it. That's what they're saying now. We've had funding cuts across so many different areas that affect Black people. And today I'm sitting with a special guest, Taylen Sharp. Taylen spent 7 semesters at Georgetown University as a Black woman, a beautiful, smart Black woman who graduated high school in the top of her class, top some percent, 10%.
The top 1%.
She was in the top 1% of her class, went to a great PWI, but great institution that initially embraced her. And then we got a new administration. And a lot of things have changed. And so we got to talk about how to literally survive this administration. Taylen, why don't you just introduce yourself? We were having just a conversation in the backyard 2 seconds ago, and it was so impactful. I just want folks to hear this story.
Yes, hello. My name is Taylen Sharp, and I am a former attendee of an elite private Jesuit institution on the Northeast, and I'm currently transferring to the alma mater of both my parents and Mr. Alan Boomer here, Morgan State University, most recently.
So we were talking about, let's go back for a second. So you're in high school, you're in the South.
Yes.
In Georgia.
Yes.
And you get into Georgetown.
Yes.
What was that like initially?
Initially, I was absolutely thrilled. At the time, they had the best French program in the nation. I had been studying French for up to 6 years at that point, so I intended to go to university. I worked really hard in high school. I was an AP National Scholar, an AP Scholar with Distinction. I took 19 AP credits with an average of 4.5 across all of them.
Lord, so you smart.
Very.
And driven.
Yes.
And hardworking.
Yes. And I was a pillar of my community. I started a nonprofit that was student-owned and student-run libraries for our high school to combat the literary crisis that we had going on in Georgia to encourage kids to read. And through all of these things, I was seen as an extremely valuable candidate for multiple higher learning institutions across the nation. And I ended up going to Georgetown University because of how initially they welcomed me and they showed that they celebrated Blackness, Black culture, and the unique perspective that I could offer. At the time, they were pushing what was called diversity in action, one of their core Jesuit principles that Georgetown purported to care about when it came to selecting their student body. It was what they told me why they wanted me.
And as we get into these questions, I want you to know this is not about bashing Georgetown University specifically. I want to really shine the light on policy and how that policy shows up in the real world and affects Black people through the lens of this brilliant Black girl. Woman, she's a woman, who went to an institution that initially embraced her, and then things changed. So initially, so you got there. How was your first couple of semesters at Georgetown?
My first semester was absolutely stunning. And I do believe that Georgetown at its core does hold on to its roots of its Jesuit values of diversity in action and care of the whole person and cura personalis. It's more of the current administration makes it hard for the university to hold on to them.
Let's go back. Your first couple semesters.
Like, my first semester.
You were in clubs. Like your first couple, you know, you were there 7 semesters. So give me like the first experience, and then later we'll talk about how things changed.
Yes. When I first attended Georgetown, I felt deeply welcomed by programs like Hoya Saxa Weekend and the historical Black House, our BSA, and our very deep Greek life. Facets of Black culture that I grew up with, seeing as my family is HBCU educated, seeing reflections of that at this higher learning, pristine university was super inspiring. I went to these events. I went to our women of color meetings. I went to our BSA meetings.
What's BSA?
Our Black Student Alliance. Our NAACP chapter. And it was super empowering. We went out into the community. We partnered with different youth organizations. We had things like DC Reads, where we go into the community and work as tutors for Black students in DC. And just being able to pour into our community of Blackness overall, pour into the local Black community, and pour into the Black community of Georgetown.
And like, how Black is Georgetown? Because it's in D.C., that's Chocolate City, but it's, you know, historically a white institution. But how Black was it? Like, what percentage of the student body was Black at the time?
So when I first came into Georgetown, Georgetown was 7.5% Black, okay, which was under the national standard. And at the time, they said, we're trying to do a lot of recruitment in order to get up to the 13%.
I mean, the crazy thing, you're in one of the Blackest cities in America. You got Allen Iverson. You got, you know, John Thompson.
Yeah.
Like, I think Georgetown, that's what you see on TV.
Yeah.
But the actual place is a little different.
For certain. As it is an elite institution, it is a deeply, deeply ingrained university in which there is a very strong wealth disparity, and that wealth informs essentially who is accepted in the culture of Georgetown. We have a population that is 70% of the top 1% of the nation when it comes to wealth, and lots of that wealth does tend to skew white. Now Georgetown's Black population has gone down to 4%.
Lord.
And when I returned to campus, I did see this disparity.
So you used the word elite.
Yes.
One thing that I always struggle with is like elite for who, right? Because it's like they come up with these rankings, whether it be U.S. News, whether it be, you know, Bloomberg, whoever. And like, it's never our schools. They never examine how do we do coming out of those places, but they call it elite and they make us want to go there and send our Black babies there. And sometimes I'm saying, like, a lot of times the results are good, but like sometimes you get folks that don't feel welcomed and embraced. So 7% Black, but they had a lot of stuff for Black students at the time.
Yes. And so after my first semester was when the COVID pandemic hit. So then everyone was off campus for my second year. And it was all digital for what was supposed to be my sophomore year. So I took that time off during the sophomore year because I think the college experience, from what I've heard from my parents and my grandparents, college is about the relationships you build outside of the classroom. It's the connections that you make and the people that you spend time with, because education is only partially what you learn, but it's also the people that you meet.
And like, I go back to this notion of diversity for a second. Like, Georgetown is nestled in a city that's very, very Black. And Georgetown itself has ties, deep historical ties to slavery. I don't know if you knew this.
Yes, Georgetown actually used to be a Black neighborhood. We used to partner with the Mount Zion band and the women's I can't remember the full name of the cemetery, but it's a historical Black cemetery in Georgetown.
But what I'm saying is this. I don't know if you knew this. I don't know if they talked about this in y'all orientation, but in 1838, Georgetown sold 272 enslaved Africans in order to get the money to, like, you know, get the school popping.
And actually, a giant coincidence is that my freshman fall, they were advocating for reconciliation of what's called the GU 272, where the students of Georgetown, all students of Georgetown, had a referendum to hold the university accountable for that sale and to push for them to find their descendants and give them legacy status and legacy admissions. So that was one of the things that Georgetown was trying to do to hold itself accountable and essentially pay reparation for the harm that was done, as Georgetown was one of the largest slaveholding institutions in the state of Maryland.
Yeah, and the money that they received, which was in the millions, for selling off its property, which were people,
yeah,
Black people, they used it to pay off their debts. They used it to expand the school. Eventually, you know, almost 200 years later, they apologized in 2017. And coincidentally, what else happened around 2017? We got a new president, and not of the university, of the United States. This new president did a lot. Really more in this second administration than the first, but to really dismantle diversity. Let's talk about, we're going to go to break because I want to spend some time just kind of like going deeper into what caused you to transfer out and really just painting a picture of what it's been like in this current administration at a place that has deep ties to slavery, but was trying to make amends.
Yes.
And now it seems like things are going backwards. I'm Alan Boomer, and you are listening to The Momentum Advisors. All right, I'm sitting here with Taylan Sharp. She's beautiful, y'all.
Thank you.
You see her picture on the podcast cover this week. She is the daughter of Miss Morgan State University, 1998, 1999. I know this because she was my Miss Morgan, her mom. And so she's like my niece. And we were just hanging out, and she was telling me her story, and I just wanted to share it. Because we really, as Black people, have to figure out how to survive these next couple of years, even though it's almost over, it seems like there's a lot to go. So, Georgetown.
Yes.
So, talk to me about how things began to get dismantled in the second administration.
So, during the second administration, during my time at Georgetown, I was facing some severe health issues, so I took a year and a half off from Georgetown. Upon my return in the fall of 2025, I came back to an entirely new institution. Georgetown used to have a very vibrant Black culture, once again, with its D9 organizations, with its strong BSA and its intercollegiate ties to the other BSAs in the city. But now we're seeing that the administration of Georgetown has started to preemptively capitulate to the restrictions.
I like these words. You really did go to Georgetown.
Yes, to these restrictions and goals of the current Trump administration to roll back what they call DEI policy, DEI activity, and DEI funding. We have what's called the CMEA, the Center of Multicultural Equity and Access at Georgetown, which was founded and advocated for by the first Black students of Georgetown, saying that the university needs to have.
And when were those first Black students?
Our first Black graduating class was in 1972, so admitted in 1968.
And just to put it in perspective, our HBCU is like Morgan State University, started in 1867. Nearly 100 years later, we get black folks graduating from Georgetown, which, I mean, like, that's a legacy that the HBCUs have of being the only place where we can go to get educated.
And to reflect on that further, Georgetown was founded in 1789. So that's almost 200 years of no black students, if not the odd black student here or there for oddity or exceptionalism. But when we're talking about equitable access, that you won't be denied solely because of your race and accepted because you are of a higher class that is foreign, that wasn't seen at Georgetown. So it's a very recent development, this black culture that's been built, very new, very fresh. It's one generation old. I've met the parents and the founders of it as I was the former student director of our historical black house. I have very deep ties with this black alumni that is working very hard to try and preserve the black Georgetown that exists.
So you said the former black house. Yeah. So talk to me about some of the stuff that used to exist that no longer does.
Well, at current, as I am very close with many people that work at the CMEA, I was privy to different conversations about the battles that they're fighting for our students and for the historical legacies that have been built at Georgetown. Places like the Black House or La Casa Latina.
And what was the Black House? It was a dorm, or was it like—
So the Black House was, when black students first got on campus, they formed an organization, and they went to a house on 36th Street, right outside of the front gates. So not technically on campus yet, but they were students living in the row homes that are outside of Georgetown. And they would gather at one of these houses. It's where they first birthed the BSA. And they made it an informal— it was technically an informal and constantly moving place for black students to gather. In 2017, it was formally made a permanent fixture of Georgetown.
Permanent. Like, permanent means, like, we can't get rid of this.
Like, there's a plaque outside the door.
Lord.
Yes. And so now they have a permanent address of 3618 N Street right here in Georgetown. But now there's a lot of push to change what Black House represented. Now, instead of it being open to any black student that wants to apply there to try to live there because they have a vision for what they want to contribute to the black culture of campus, they want to turn it into essentially a factory of perfectionism. They want to find what the university picks as an exemplar student and turn it into a mentoring activity.
Are there still black people in the black house?
So it is open to all students, and they can't discriminate upon race for who lives in the black house.
Okay.
Or who applies to the black house.
Yeah.
So it's now, and what it's trying to turn into, from what I last heard, back in the spring of 2026, that they're trying to revamp the concept and no longer have it as a cultural institution to provide a safe haven for a black student experience, but rather turn it into a professional development program that's open to anybody, and removing the heart of what it was.
And no diversity focus at all. Like, just anybody that wants to come and better themselves, really at the expense of the black folks feeling comfortable and safe.
Yeah, so Black House used to have what was called an open door policy, where black students would just be able to go in and print for free. They would host black club organizations in the Black House. Any black organization could use it for whatever needs and purposes that they had. It was a place to find supplemental funding for events, for gatherings, for— if we wanted to have a speaker come, if we wanted to have a black senator or a black representative from one of the multiple embassies of African and Caribbean nations, you could host them at the Black House. But as they are shifting its purpose and its core, I'm seeing that the institution is trying to limit what Black House has been and what it could be, a place of revolutionary change and radical acceptance of and for Black people.
What else has changed?
The administration of Georgetown is responding to the threats, the very real and active threats. I'm not going to discredit Georgetown for trying to keep its institution alive, as we've seen the active attacks on Columbia University, right?
And Harvard.
And Harvard University, attacks on Stanford, UChicago, Yale. The current administration of Trump is very much against higher learning and higher education, as when you learn more, you know more, you have more empathy for the world around you, for the people around you. And these elite institutions have created very viable pathways for Black people to go into the middle class, upper middle class, and absolutely revolutionize the way that they walk through the world. And they are upset at this, that the people that are leaders in DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion, are coming from these institutions where we sit and we analyze quite literally the circumstances that are created outside of one's control that directly contribute to how you will be able to move through the world. It's sociology. It's the gender education, it's race education, it's sexuality education, understanding that these are interlinking forms of existence that inform how you can live in America. And so these institutions, they go, they do this extraordinary research, this groundbreaking research. I mean, Georgetown has a phenomenal, phenomenal sociology department, a phenomenal English department, a phenomenal Black studies department, where people have gone and done revolutionary research, revolutionary historical activism to uncover and to share what has made up so much of the Black experience, so much of the female experience in America. But the current presidential administration doesn't want universities like Georgetown to go and share this information, as it gives credibility to things that go against what the president's cabinet believes.
Lord, so how does it make you feel?
It felt intolerable. Being with professors that I know have been able to previously share not only what they believe, but what they've researched, and now have to sit and entertain what they call a marketplace of ideas, in which you can't push back against harmful stereotypes or destructive conversation in a classroom that's actively working to discredit Black people, our contributions to this nation, to this country, and the world writ large, because the Trump administration might strike them down. We can't have a Black graduation anymore. Our legal department at Georgetown was actively pushing against our CMEA's Black graduation. And
what was the Black graduation?
So it's not a separate graduation ceremony. It's not where your degree is conferred to you. It's quite literally a gathering where the Black graduates of the class come together and they're bestowed with a stole that has kente cloth and it has Georgetown on it and whatever their graduation class is, celebrating them for their accomplishments to come through here, come through that university, create a sense of community, and to reflect on the memories that they've made together for their very unique experience. There's not just a Black graduation. There's also a Native graduation. There's an Asian graduation. There's a Latino graduation. For all the different, there's a what's called the Lavender graduation for queer students on campus. There are so many celebrations for people that walk through life differently and highlighting the different struggles you might have had going to a university that is not just Catholic, but Jesuit, one of the oldest Catholic universities in America, that is historically conservative, that is historically not accepting of people that looked like you, that believe the things that you believe, that love the way that you love, that's the gender that you are. So to highlight that you are making progress, you are part of the progress of the University of Georgetown is what these graduations are for. Not to say, oh, we don't like white students or white students aren't welcome, but to highlight you did something and you had something extra that you had to conquer as well.
Man, I'm like in tears a little bit because the thing about it, Taylin, like I've known you not like a long, long time. But in the time I've gotten to know you, like, I've been so impressed by you every time. You truly represent, like, our boldest and brightest.
Thank you.
And, like, you went to a place that embraced you at first, and then you come back, and it's, like, night and day. Like, it's almost like the organization that owns slaves is now back on that type of time again. You know, it's like such a night and day experience. And we got to survive this. We got to survive this.
Yes. And again, not to discredit the university, but they're trying to do their best to survive as a billion-dollar entity against what is the Trump administration, something that's threatening to take their accreditation, their ability to continue to educate people and continue to make worldwide leaders. If you're taking away a place that people can feel like they can be themselves and have their beliefs and to be confident in their marginalized identities, then you effectively cap the limits and the potential of that institution. The reason why Georgetown initially was pushing for this diversity was because they saw the value in having people coming from different backgrounds and different ideas as it pushed Georgetown to get ventures that they never would have found, never would have saw, because they understand the diversity of thought is a strength. That being able to have people from different backgrounds with different positionalities in life allows you to find more creative solutions. However, with this new administration, they're more afraid of being shut down than they are of not producing the greatest of leaders. We've seen Black enrollment half since I first started. So it's not that Georgetown doesn't care about Black people and it doesn't care about Black students, but what they do care about is ensuring that they can continue to exist, so they'll select for the people that will fall in line for what they believe in.
But I gotta push back for a second, Taylin. I gotta push back.
Of course.
Because like you're so forgiving, like Black people are. Like we embrace everybody, we forgive everybody, and we listen to the excuses of everybody. Georgetown has $4 billion in its endowment, with a B.
Yes.
With $4 billion, you don't think Georgetown could survive 2 years of this administration? Like, I'm being difficult here for a moment because, and I highlight Georgetown with its $4 billion, and we're talking about they need to survive. Like, bruh, like Black people have been out here surviving with way less than $4 billion for a long time. Like, Georgetown can figure out a way, if they wanted to, if the will was there, they could figure out a way to fight back. What's really upset me so much about these Ivy institutions, most of them, not all, about these quote-unquote so-called elite institutions, and I'm being facetious a little bit with that, because I'm not saying they're bad schools. They folded in like 5 minutes to these demands. They immediately went back on everything, which makes me feel like, did they even care? Or were they only down with us because they felt guilty for temporarily? Or were they only down with us because they thought it was popular? Because the moment that it got uncomfortable, and this is my challenge to our white allies, like, you got to be down with us when it gets difficult. That's the time we most need you to be down with us, especially if you've got resources like $4 billion, like Georgetown University.
And I appreciate the pushback, because as much as I do want to give grace to Georgetown, the institution, but more importantly, the people of Georgetown that make it so wonderful of why I stayed there so long. You're absolutely right that at the end of the day, it is a decision of I'd rather be comfortable and not have issues than stand up and support the people that we claim to support. I think a lot of the support of, like I said earlier, they understood the value, a monetary value, of finding people from different backgrounds, as it gives you more ideas, it gives you diversity of thought, leads to diversity of profit, right? And they're looking for genuinely the best and brightest. The best and brightest of Georgetown does not come from the legacies, the people that have gone to Georgetown for four generations, the people whose names are on buildings, the people who come from the top 1%. That is essentially just an ecosystem of network of opportunity, because these are children of the successful people that went there before. These aren't the best and brightest, as they haven't had to work for what is there. They haven't had to grind and truly have a passion for education and learning. And though they have access to the entire world, their worldview in itself is very small.
Let me ask you one question. As a student there, in this last semester you were there, because of, like, I find that, like, racism is, like, on, I won't say it's on the rise. I think it's just, it's more prevalent. I think that folks who were maybe inwardly racist are now emboldened to be outwardly racist.
Before.
What was the climate like? Because there's always the students, right? The administration can do what it's going to do, but the students, you would hope, are different. But what was that like?
I came to a very hostile Georgetown. I came to a Georgetown that did not want to see Black people that were happy to be Black and proud of their Blackness and their roots, that did not want to see organizations like the NCNW, the,
which is the
National Coalition of Negro Women, mm-hmm. which is a Black women's organization for Black women, centering explicitly Black women. And I attempted to start a section at the university, and our student organization board, one thing about Georgetown is that so much of its bureaucracy is ran by students for students, and they denied our application. As they said, we don't see a need for this on our campus.
Yeah, and
a pickle eating club got accepted for a new club.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
Wait a minute.
But we couldn't establish the NCNW.
NCNW, by the way, was founded in 1925 by Dr. Mary McLeod Bethune, who's one of our, you know,
fundamental civil rights leaders.
Yeah,
she founded Bethune-Cookman University.
Yes.
She genuinely is an icon, a friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. She advocated so much for Black women and Black people before it was popular to include all Black people in our advocacy. As many people know, when the civil rights era was going on, many people said, we need to get our Black men the right to vote first, and women will follow. Mrs. McLeod said that is nonsense. She said that we need to fight for Black women and their struggles, because the struggles of Black women affect their families, it protects their families, it uplifts their families. So if we are able to uplift the Black woman, we uplift all Black people. Essentially, she's an early understander and an early conceptualizer of what's called intersectionalism, in which one understands the crossroads of identity of being both woman and being Black comes with their separate individual struggles. And then when you are both, they intersect and compound in unique ways. So Georgetown wanted to found other clubs on campus, but being part of NCNW was not acceptable. When we posted flyers to have students come out, we would come the next morning and see our posters ripped down, but other posters still up.
And did you have any, let's say, direct racist encounters?
I've had.
Which I hope you haven't.
I have, unfortunately.
Oh, my God.
I studied French for 6 years before attending Georgetown, and I came into Georgetown as a French major. But I found that the French department of Georgetown was highly hostile to Black people, particularly Black people that celebrate and uplift the cultural legacies of French colonies. My particular dialect of French has lots of West African influences, as my longest teacher of French lived in Senegal for 15 years. Her French is colored by the accents of the Senegalese coast, of Côte d'Ivoire, of the Wolof people. And when I speak French, my accent reflects that. Mm. My best friend that I made through Georgetown's French program, and we're now friends for life, she's of Haitian descent. So her French accent is touched by her Haitian background. We were the only two French Black-speaking kids in the major at the time, just the two of us. And we were told that it was acceptable for us to be bullied by our classmates, in fact, encouraged by a professor for how we speak. Our professor told our class that it's okay to interrupt Maya and Taylan while we speak to correct our pronunciation. However, we had a white Cuban who was from Florida, and when he spoke French, it sounded like Italian. My French sounds like a French dialect, but his sounded like Italian. But because he was white, it was okay. There were people that spoke very poorly, but it was not seen as okay to interrupt them. And on my first day of class, I remember my teacher, I got there early, and it was the first day of class with him. He asked me, "Are you from the suburbs?" Which from itself sounds like an innocent sentence if you don't understand French culture. So not only did I study French language, I also studied French culture for 6 years. And asking someone if they grew up in the suburbs is the equivalent of asking, "Are you from the ghetto?" In French. And so when I asked him, "Excuse me, why did you ask me that?" He was like, no, I just wanted to ask you where you were from. But to make that assumption, to think you could say that to me, was absurd. And when I went to make a bias report against him, he got promoted to dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. So I saw that there was no viability for me to continue down that path of the French major in the French department.
I mean, first y'all colonize us, make us learn your language, and then critique us on not learning it well enough.
Not speaking it in your way, not speaking it in the way of the nation of France, not the nation of Switzerland. But if you are proud of the French African world, the African Francophonic world is stunning, with a rich history of resilience, a rich history of culture, a rich history of survival. And if you want to celebrate that, as I'm not of direct West African descent, but I see the beauty of it. I see all that it carries and all that it pushes towards. And to be proud of being Black and being proud of resilience of Black stories, I gravitated towards it, of course. But to celebrate these things was to be punished.
Oh, my God. Taylan, we've got to survive this.
We do.
And on that note, we're going to go to break. When we come back, let's focus on that aspect. We are just having a conversation about how to survive this second Trump administration. We'll go to break, and we come back, we'll talk about some solutions. I'm Alan Boomer, and we are the Momentum Advisors. And we're back. This is a deep episode today. It started with me and Taylan and her mom and some other friends sitting in the backyard talking, and Taylan was just telling me about transferring to Morgan State University, and I'm happy about that as a Morgan grad, and her mom and her dad are Morgan grads as well. But I was surprised, and I asked a couple probing questions, and all this started to come out. I want to give you a quote from the late, great Mary McLeod Bethune. "If we have the courage and tenacity of our forebears, who stood firmly like a rock against the lash of slavery, we shall find a way to do for our day what they did for theirs." And that quote is about survival. It's about the fact that we've already gone through so much and it's in our blood to overcome. Mm. So let's talk about solutions. I'll start with one. One of the things that we need to do is go back to like being together in our institutions, in our Black churches, in our HBCUs, yeah, in our Black-led organizations like the NAACP and Color of Change. And we got to band together and we can't be waiting on folks to save us. We got to save ourselves. Like, you took a step in that direction going to Morgan State University. Talk about that.
Well, yes. My mother has started her second season of her life. And when I was going back to school, she moved back to Maryland from Georgia. And I watched how her Morgan community embraced her. I watched how this community she told me about that she experienced during college, which were the best years of her life, where she found family for life, where she found friends for life. When she came back, it was like nothing ever stopped. Like, no time had passed between the last day she was on campus to now. And to see how her community has come together for her to embrace her in her ventures, in her professional career, after being a fantastic housewife and mother to three children, it was warming my heart to see the family that she talks about that she found at her university. I often hear stories from my grandfather telling me stories of when he went to Virginia State, then college, now university, of how these friendships, these brotherhoods, molded him into the person that he was today, the support that they had when facing against overt racism and situations I find to be mirroring the experience that I find as a young Black person in America now today. His stories resonate with me now more than ever. And as I was continuing to go to Georgetown and face these different harassments due to me being Black, I felt like I just could not continue there anymore. I had pushed so hard for so long because, as you said, Alan, Black people have been resilient, as the great McLeod Bethune. Yes.
McLeod.
Yes.
I see McLeod.
Yes. She said, again, you stand as a rock against the lashings of slavery. We were able to push through these hard things, and wanting to push through doesn't just mean standing where you're not wanted, but moving in a collective. A collection of rocks can stop a tide of water.
Lord, you preaching now. Yeah. So that's the first one. So let's go back to our institutions. Let's rebuild our institutions. Let's embrace them. Let's infuse them with new capital, new resources, new leadership. And we'll find strength there, like a collection of rocks. Yeah. I love that. I love that. I think next, we got to do business with one another as Black people. So, Taylan, you attended my wife's 50th birthday celebration. I don't know if you know this, but I'm going to brag for a second. Black-owned venue.
Wow.
Black caterer.
Wow.
Black entertainment.
Yes.
In terms of the band and the DJ.
Which was phenomenal.
Black decorator.
Wow.
Black everything.
Yes.
Like, that was not a cheap celebration, but that money that was spent, it is in our community. It's multiplying because there were young Black students who were working that venue who now have some money in their pocket that they can go out and spend. And it just recycles. Your mom, who I love, by the way, is now my partner in our Zips dry cleaning operation down in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And we're hiring folks that look like us.
Intentionally.
And a lot of our clients, our customers look like us.
Yes.
Like, we got to get back to the old school of doing business with one another.
Yes. And that is genuinely the key to success. And I've seen it mirrored at Georgetown. One of the reasons why those circles are so successful is because they intentionally turn to their community to pour into it. oh, you went to Georgetown. Oh, you're so-and-so's son. I know you from here in this time. I want to invest in your venture. I know you're 21 with no experience and no real-world acumen. But because I want to invest in our community, invest in the capital that I believe in, we're putting it towards your community. We're putting it towards you. And so when Black people turn to spend at Black businesses, to hire, like you said, Black event spaces, Black caterers, Black music, Black DJs, we're going and investing in our community, which does the work of genuinely uplifting and turning around communities.
And you gave me the next point. We got to create some Black nepotism. We got to hire our friends, kids.
Yes.
We got to put them into positions like, you know, no disrespect to white folks, but they have been doing this for years.
Centuries,
putting people in position that, and you can look at this current administration, like how many not qualified folks do you see running all manners of branches of the government? And they'll figure it out. We need to put our Black babies, our Black children, our Black sons and daughters into positions where they can learn and they can thrive and they can skip to the front of the line the way other communities do.
And you're absolutely right, Alan. We see at companies like Georgetown is a feeder school for McKinsey. We're seeing students with no degrees walking into these opportunities, earning $100,000 across one summer because their dad's friend put in a word for them. Because someone that they knew said, my friend has a child and they can be in this position. It doesn't matter if they don't know all the things, they didn't work their heart off, they don't know SQL, you know? And that's cool. We will put him in this position so that way he gains the experience and more importantly, the networks of people. Because that's what I learned college is all about. It's about who you know, the connections you make, and capitalizing on them. Saying, I knew you from this time. I would love to be in this space with you. And that's how we build a sense of, like you said, Black nepotism, giving our children, giving my peers a chance to be in these high value spaces, even though they might not have, quote, earned it. They might not have worked the hardest. They might not have gone above and beyond and been the very best on paper, but they also deserve the chance to have opportunity the same just because of connections and networks.
Yeah, we have some successful Black people. Some own businesses like myself. Some are executives at places like McKinsey and Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch and you name it.
Deloitte.
And we got to put our people in position. I've always made an attempt. Like, I've got this interesting circumstance. I have three children. I love them to death. But none of my kids are interested in finance. So, like, this summer, I've got a godson working for me. I've actually got one of my son's Asian homeboys working for me. He's an NYU student. I have one of my associates at my firm is one of my god's children. Taylor, I'm about to recruit you. I'm like, listen, French, we might need to get a French branch.
Je peux parler en français. C'est pas un problème.
So I'm just saying we got to create some Black nepotism. I love that. Other ideas. We really got to be playing chess.
Yes.
And that involves us getting involved with the political structure.
Yes.
Like we can't be like just passengers.
Or apathetic.
We can't be apathetic.
And I think truly being involved in politics shifts the position of Black people in this world. It's not a coincidence that there are over 60 senators in history that have come from Georgetown, that there's people all across politics, up and down, that are from Georgetown University. They breed for that. They actively push for that. And what I see is that when you have people in positions of power, it gives you an in to advocate for the people that you care about, to advocate for positive change and make positive action. When Black people come together to vote, it does truly change what this nation looks like. There's a reason why this current administration really wanted to push through the SAVE Act bill, because inside of it is not just, oh, lump sum spending money for, quote, consumers, which isn't true if you look at the details, but shoehorned in is getting rid of mail-in voting, getting rid of early voting, and limiting voter registration and voter ID implication. They're trying to bring back, quite literally, the things that Black people fought to eliminate during civil rights. They're trying to bring back essentially a poll tax. If you need a passport because you need two valid forms of ID, most people just have their driver's license. Mm-hmm. A passport costs $168. And for a struggling Black family, that's another tax you're adding to be able to vote in this country. Something you have to pay every 10 years, an additional $168, and that's not including an expedition fee, because God forbid your passport expires. And voting is now limited to in-person, where you have to bring your ID because they're getting rid of mail-in voting. You have to expedite that fee. That's now $250 to get a passport. They're implementing poll taxes the long way. They're trying to silence the Black vote on purpose. They recently made gerrymandering legal as long as it's not for, quote, racial purposes. But it's only called racial purposes when it's benefiting Black people. When it benefits non-Black people, it's just standard gerrymandering. There is an agenda to silence Black people in this nation, to silence the political activity of Black people, because Black people will always find a way to thrive. They'll always find a way to turn that lemon into a lemonade.
Word. Okay, Beyonce. I think we got to look at our Black stuff differently.
Yes.
We can't look at our Black stuff and say, oh, it's not as good. Like, our HBCUs aren't as elite as our PWIs.
And that's not true.
Our Black restaurants, the food isn't as good as the Michelin star. Like, Michelin star, like that, we're not getting Michelin stars. They're not giving it to us. We have to look at our stuff like it's just as good, if not better.
And I do think that there is an apprehension culturally when it comes to buying Black. Because there's there is, like you said, an assumption that it's of a lower standard, of a lower quality. However, that's not what it is. It's a reflection of the lessened access to capital that Black people have.
Come on now, Taylor.
If Black people had the same access to capital, being able to own their own means of production, being able to generate their own means of production, it would be just as good. If Black people, if you wanted a Black-owned purse to be of the same quality of Hermes, which is the brand that makes Birkins, or a Kelly, or a Peugeot, for those that really, really like bags.
I could tell you're into this. You should see her smile right now.
I love good leather craftsmanship. Yeah. I love a good leather. If Black people have access to the leather and imported themselves from Italy,
or had the capital to raise the cows, like what happens in a lot of these manufacturers.
Yes, because they own the farms, the tanning facilities. They own the places that build their sewing machines. They have unique sewing machines. They create and own their own production from top to bottom. When Black people have less access to capital, they have less access to find the raw products and build it to the specifications and the ability that they want. Most Black businesses are taking what capital they have and making the most of the situation that they have going on. Mm-hmm. But when you support these businesses, we see that they elevate, we see that they grow, we see that they become stronger, that they have more refinement because they have the capital to do so. We must invest in our communities, invest in our neighbors, invest in our neighborhoods in order to turn these communities into what we know they are and deserving to be.
Taylan, that is a mic drop moment. Yo, what are you studying? You said French. What else are you studying?
Currently, I am, as I transferred to Morgan this past summer, which is just now, just the transferring process has been so illuminating. And I've been feeling that family and the love and the sense of belonging at Morgan that I've been longing for and actively working to build towards at Georgetown, I found before I was even admitted to the university. But once I was admitted, that outpour was overflowing. I'm now getting dual degrees in both English and urban studies. So a BA in English and a BS in urban studies.
Why urban studies?
I've always had a curiosity for the world around us. And at Georgetown, it's a liberal arts college, so it's a lot more flexible with what you need to take in order to graduate. So I've always taken optional electives, looking on urban development, urban studies, sociology, essentially, to understand the world that Black people live in, to understand the world that, like, my family's come from, my grandfather grew up in, the realities of many and most Black people around this country, and understanding what I can do in order to make it better, to illuminate the issues, to participate in our civil services, in order to give back to what I'm very proud of coming from, being Black and an American.
Wow. Hey, we're out of time. But I hope that you appreciated this conversation today. Very different. Normally, you listen to our podcast, and you hear financial tips and strategies. And sometimes we got to do that. But sometimes we also need to take a step back and look from 30,000 feet in the sky and think about what the impact is, even at the micro level, from some of these big picture things. And we got to get back to the major big picture planning and strategizing. Before we go, do you have any socials or any things you want to shout out?
Yes, actually. When I was at Georgetown, I was an English major and I took a lot of courses talking about the development of self and becoming oneself, but I never saw narratives like mine, which is why I founded the THEHBCU Archive on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And what I'm doing is collecting the narratives of HBCU alums to highlight the foundations of the HBCU culture that we see today. So looking at people that graduated in the 60s and 70s, all the way up to the 2000s, in order to reflect on what cultural elements have we created to see what Black academia is, what it looks like, and essentially the buildings roman of Black people. Follow me there. You can always DM me at THEHBCUARCHIVE, the HBCU Archive on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Please send me a DM, send me a follow. I'd love to interview you and hear your story about how you've contributed to Black academic culture as an alum of your proud HBCU.
You got a voice for this. You got a mind for this. You have a talent for this. So I appreciate you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're so sweet. Well, thank you, listener. If you want to talk about your actual financial situation, not just us hypothecating and, you know, evangelizing, you know, if you want to take a look at your retirement strategy, your readiness for your financial goals, feel free to reach out to Momentum Advisors. Go to our website, momentum-advisors.com/contact, and you can schedule time with me or any of the other very talented, very diverse financial advisors at my firm. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week. I'm Alan Boomer, and we are the Momentum Advisors. Momentum.
Yeah.